My name's James Walters. I'm the chaplain here at the LSE, and I'm a fellow of the Institute of Public Affairs, who's hosting this evening's annual Quebec lecture. So I'd like to welcome you all to the LSE Faith Centre for this preliminary event, I shan't say warm-up event, and particularly representatives from the Quebec Government Office in London who've made this dialogue possible. Our principal guest today is, of course, the distinguished philosopher, Professor Charles Taylor, Professor Emeritus at McGill University and winner of the 2007 Templeton Prize. His dialogue partner is a very familiar face to us, our director, Craig Calhoun. Both have been significant contributors to the debates around the nature of secularism and the place of religion in the world today. So they'll have a dialogue on some of the themes in the future of faith for around 45 minutes, and then we'll take some questions from you on the floor to involve you. We're recording this event for a podcast, so I just ask that your mobile phones are switched off or turned to silent, and you may wish to tweet, in which case we're using the hashtag #FutureOfFaith. So, Charles Craig, I wonder if we can begin our conversation, perhaps in the space that we're in. This Faith Centre is a new facility that we opened nearly 2 years ago for religious observance and for interfaith dialogue. And it's a space that has been created after 120 years of the LSE being around as a secular university and not seeing the need for such a space. So I suppose as we consider the questions around the future of faith, the question comes, well, the future of faith where? And at this university, we gather students from all around the world and have a melting pot, a fusion of different perspectives. So I wonder what this space says about the future of faith, or at least the present state of play. I don't know who wants to kick us off.
Well, yeah, I think what it says is that we're entering a era. Now, it's not everywhere, but in the West, certainly, but not only the West, but certainly the West. We're entering an era in which, instead of having societies organized around a single dominant or established faith, which, of course, the U.S. was never, but every European country was, you know, more or less far or near in the past, instead of having a society organized around a single church or a single faith position, we have a society in which people are more and more finding their own paths, finding their own spiritual paths, finding their own direction. Even if they remain belonging to the same church as before, they very often find different ways of understanding that and, as it were, taking that as the basis of a spiritual path, and they mostly don't all belong to the same. So the issue is, what kind of life together does this, well, two questions. What kind of life together does this require, and what kind of life together does this kind of thing stimulate or suggest? And I think that this kind of encounter becomes both more common and more necessary, which we can sort of work into the detail of that. But I think that's what this site triggers off in me. Yeah.
Well, let me pick up on a theme of that, Charles, if I can. In a way, you describe three different experiences that seem to come together, of each of several different faiths becoming more plural internally, so a new kind of plurality inside Christianity or Islam or other faiths. Movement among faiths or among specific groups, and a kind of seeking beyond specific doctrines or churches or other orthodoxies. So is there a sense in which the world of faith now is more free, that freedom is more allied to faith rather than opposed to it?
Yes, I mean, definitely when we had these sort of national churches, there were very strong boundaries set from on top and people had to abide by them. The more so, you see, we have to raise this concept, the concept of Christendom is against Christianity. The concept of Christendom is the concept of a society which is entirely informed out of the Christian faith. Its politics, its art, its moral concepts, its way of conceiving everything. So we have lived from roughly, I mean, very oversimple, from Constantine until yesterday in the West, certainly in Latin Christendom. We've lived a Christendom. And it had, you know, it's Pascal talks about grand de la misère, its greatness and its less great elements. But that is, the point is, that is over. That nobody, I mean, lots and lots and lots of people who may remain Christian and they remain in the same denomination, they just don't want to have that kind of belonging. And if you go into reasons why that is not desired now, as well as reasons why it's broken up. But I think that is a fundamental difference in predicament. So Christians, Jews, Muslims, whatever, in the West today are very much like, for instance, Christians in Africa or India. Their plight is to be alongside a whole lot of other people with a whole lot of other faith positions, including non-Adjeans.
I'm conscious, sitting here as a chaplain who's a priest in an established church, so I recognise part of what you say, but it's also Christendom, I guess, is still around in some ways. And I suppose that points to the question with this new complexity about hosting and being a guest and how that plays out. And I wonder how you see that in the Western context and perhaps in other contexts, how faith communities might be able to host some new plurality.
Yeah, I mean, the English establishment, like every other English thing, is very strange. So it's not what people often think of as establishment, because, and there is within English the continued establishment of the Anglican Church, there's been this sort of move to pluralize that. I mean, to have members of the House of Lords who are, etc., nominated from other faiths. So the word is somehow, you know, factually correct, but the spirit in which it's lived is very, very different. Now, the Anglican Church also had the great advantage of being very plural in the approaches that it gathered into itself, right? So it was kind of arranged in order to fit better into this kind of world. But I think that even where you have this fundamental agreement, and therefore we either force people, or at best we have these, like in France, if you have these areas where the Huguenots are allowed to operate, you know, but carefully surrounded in a cordon sanitaire and so on. You see, that it's that mindset. You know, a lot of people have that mindset today. One of the problems with a certain kind of secularism or laïcité, in France is that they think the same idea. We have to be united, only this time not with a religion, but with a, you know.
So we might have a unifying non-religion.
That's right.
We all don't believe, but in the same way. <That's> in your account, if I hear it correctly, the secularism doesn't mean simply the non-religious.
Oh.
And it grows with religious plurality. It is in part the idea of a world in which religions relate to each other and religious people relate to each other and to those who are not religious, inhabiting a common space,
yeah,
but not necessarily the same as atheism or unbelief.
Yeah, is that? Yeah. I mean, there are two models to Western secularism or laïcité, depending which language you're speaking. One is the one that started in the States, where the problem was we're very diverse, how are we going to coexist, right? So you have the no establishment clause. And the other is the one that really we think of in France, where you had this tremendous struggle between Republica and laïcité on one side and a potentially hegemonic church on the other side. So there it meant putting religion in its place, you know, stopping it from taking over. So these are two models. And you know, their two models are still alive today in people's minds, right? Although I'm very biased, I think only the first model makes sense for us today, but there are proponents of the other model.
Is there also a phenomenon in which the meaning of religion changes, not just religion in society changes, no, because there's not this superordinate idea of one dominant faith, but with this pluralization, the meaning of being part of any one of these faiths is changed for people in a recognition of that being not simply the obvious background that everybody shares, but something specific to you. You are somebody who has this faith, who embraces this position, which implies someone might not. You might not under some other circumstances.
Yeah, and I mean, not only you might not, but you know people that are certainly brighter, or just as bright as you, and very often better or just as good as you, and so on, in all any kind of dimension, you know, who have another view,
right,
who have a very different
view. What happens historically then is that it's not a movement from tight orthodoxy to fluidity, in a sense, because part of what's opened up is the codification and the increase in orthodoxy and the raising of the stakes of which religion you belong to, expecting lay people, not just clergy, to have strong ideas about religion, so that this is, in an interesting way, the production of orthodoxies precisely because of heterodoxy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And because, you see, I think you could put it this way. It's a new situation for everybody, a situation in which the structures of Christendom no longer hold, or they no longer actually exist properly in a overarching way, or they certainly no longer hold your allegiance. And people have to start, if people want to remain Christian, or Catholic, or Protestant, or Jew, they have to start thinking what this means, and this kind of inevitable, you can't avoid, in a certain way, innovating, having a different way of living it, right? And then there is a reaction of people who don't like the idea of Christendom fading away, right? And they fighting very strongly against this. So we have, in all churches today, this kind of unfortunate polarization between, well, they're called conservatives and, liberals isn't the right word, but I mean, you know, innovators or non-innovators. And we have very often extremely tense relations, which is, you know, really unfortunate. But the fact is that this is a growing field of those who are outside of that. So you get, I mean, phenomena like, I want to mention Bonhoeffer here, this great German, if you like, dissident who was fighting against the Nazis, where he talks about a religionless, what he meant by religion, see, was this close tie between the faith on one hand and a set of customs and a set of national institutions and a set of a national identity on the other hand, which he thought was very poisonous because, of course, Hitler was using that Germanism to, seduce away certain German Lutherans into the national church, and he was very much opposed to that. So you get this very clear intuition in Bonhoeffer that you have to innovate. You have to become, you know, to continue Lutheran Christianity, it has to be done in a quite different way, unhooked from a society which is officially that and which has all, you know, all those folk ways and rules and national identities. And you get this again and again and again. And of course, on the Catholic side, someone like Mounier, you know, made a great impression on me in the early period after the war. He wrote a book called Feu la Chrétienté, no, The Late Christendom, in which he made this very strong point.
So the LSE,
I take it back to Jim's introduction. You talk about the LSE and its secular history and the place of faith in it. It
seems to be one of the ways to think about what you're talking about is students come to the LSE from a variety of communities, including communities in which there are dominant religions. And they come to the LSE, and part of the LSE experience is there are all these other people who have all kinds of different beliefs. They come in more different varieties than ever I thought possible. And that's both a challenging experience. Some people find it unsettling. Other people find it clarifying about what they, in fact, believe or what their own location is. But it is, in a way, a microcosm of the experience you're saying is the modern experience.
And plainly, we're moving into a world in which that's more and more the case. So, but not just in the West. I mean, take any large, what people call globalizing city, you know, Mumbai, Tokyo, Sao Paulo, you name it, they have all this feature that side by side, there's just an incredible number of different faith positions and non-faith positions that you just meet every day and you have to, you know, rub shoulders with. So more and more of the world's population is moving into this kind of context.
Can I just push the kind of future of faith question a little bit more? And Bonhoeffer, you've raised, kind of presents this to us, that he didn't just believe that faith needed to be reconceived beyond the apparatus of Christendom and religiosity and so forth, but certainly towards the end of his life, talking about the world come of age, really believing that Christianity needed to be rethought without the apparatus of transcendence. And that Christianity really needs to be sort of re-received on the immanent plane, which is obviously ties into a lot of your work. And I think the question that's the fault line you point to earlier in terms of the tensions within churches is a lot of people will look at Bonhoeffer and say, well, that really was a failed enterprise. We can't reconceive in that way. We need to we need to reimagine in the context of the transcendent, while others may persist. And I just wonder how successful you think, not necessarily Bonhoeffer's project, but thinking about, is the future of faith on the immanent plane an authentically religious faith?
Yeah. You see, well, I read Bonhoeffer somewhat differently. But, of course, I mean, I'm you're the theologian, so I'm probably totally wrong. Okay, but the Bonhoeffer I received, maybe totally wrong, but I find very interesting. Because I don't find him quite saying that. I find him saying that to be, coming of age, being in the modern world, is standing in a universe which is deprived of all the formerly recognized pathways beyond it. Now, if we go back to the early modern period, the Middle Ages, one of the pathways beyond is the cosmos is all ordered to the good and it's pointing beyond itself to the good. Or we have this idea of the universe is perfect design of God and Newton and so on, so it points to God. Or we have the idea of sort of an enchanted universe in which spirits are moving around, angels and so on, and they point beyond. Now, we live in this radically disenchanted universe, and so live in the sense that what we're aware of day by day, what we're aware of as we share with everyone else, is a universe in terms of its natural, you know, operations, Newton, Galileo, and so on, in terms of its political orders. They're all set up by somebody in some point in 1787 or whatever. And then within that, can you be drawn to something which really goes beyond this? But that can't be hooked onto anything that's a recognizable institution that's telling you God is there. And it's that. It's not the absence of transcendence. Well, I mean, the issue of what transcendence means, we had this up with Craig, was very critical of my book, and rightly so, because I threw this word around a little bit too easily. You know, there are 25 different meanings to it. So very, very slippery.
One of the things is, I think, in this Bonhoeffer-influenced discussion, is transcendence has to be found in a more personalized way rather than as institutionally available. Yeah. So that part of the contrast that's being evoked is that in many contexts historically, there have been accounts of the worldly and what's beyond that are institutionally conveyed, and you know, you learn them in certain settings, you participate in them, you may find a religious vocation, lots of things happen. Bonhoeffer is suggesting if that's wiped out, it doesn't mean transcendence is wiped out, but it does mean that the challenge as an individual to find what that can mean for you is greatly
It suddenly comes out to the,
And so I wonder, I mean, you've talked a lot about, and many, many others have talked about what are often called seekers, but I would say also not just seekers in the sense of people trying to find their right religion and shopping among different ones, but within a quest, a journey, an idea of the individual's challenge to figure out what faith means for him or her in this modern context. Is this sort of an extension of that idea?
Yeah, actually. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's something that is very old in Christendom anyway. You see, I mean, I take the, you know, the particular church I belong to, the Catholic Church. Well, its great achievements have been the development constantly of new spiritualities, of, you know, the Franciscan, the Dominican, the Jesuit, the famous ones, but also many others. And you find in our day, people, Charles de Foucault, you find Jean Vanier, is our great Canadian in this regard, innovating new ways in which to live that. Now, this great inventivity was always there, in a sense, but it was in the context of this large casing that everybody belonged to and so on. The casing has fallen away, in a certain sense, right? That is, we have to reconstitute these forms of collective existence, which we call churches, without that, by bringing together people who are seeking in these different directions. Yeah.
So I wonder, in a sense, what you're saying is that the horizontality has held together through a certain personalization, as Craig's saying, the onus on the individual to recover that transcendence. And I wonder whether part of the tensions that we're now seeing is between an understanding of the future of faith as essentially personalist and a future of the faith as more politicized.
That's right, that's right. And, well, because there is a great fear of the decline of the civilizational, sort of embedding of religion. And that, of course, is what gives rise to various kinds of fundamentalism. And it's not an accident that in the Islamic world, these also have arisen, because you also have societies that have been at various times totally Islamic, or I mean officially, but maybe with tolerated minorities, right? So, and that too, that kind of strain is arising there as well, with some of the same polarizing.
So to throw in a provocative term, might that constitute a clash of civilizations?
Well, no, you see, it constitutes a clash within each civilization. That's the, you know, I mean, that's what we're always fighting about. Right? Within Western civilization, I mean, does it only make sense if it all centers in Rome and the Vatican? Or, no, that's not the sense that we can make of it. We can make of it that we have a certain number of very profound common aspirations, human rights, democracy, and so on, which we're living, and we've got to find a way of living together without fighting, right? So it's a fight within each civilization. And in the case in the Islamic world, it's even more dramatic, because the various forms of fundamentalism have radically narrowed the range of spiritualities that have been traditionally very present in Islamic societies. And as a matter of fact, you find now there's a fight back. I mean, there's an international movement of Sufi, you know, traditions which are trying to wrest back a place within that tradition. So, and this is, it's a fight within Islam.
It's not completely different from fights within Christianity at earlier periods.
Exactly.
When there were Protestant sects saying we should have no stained glass windows, we should not have pipe organs, we shouldn't have music in the service.
Yeah.
That kind of
Puritan response is not completely different from response within Islam or other faiths.
Yeah, yeah.
And similarly, there are others who are saying we can find happy coexistence with a more secular worldly culture, and those who are saying, no, we must make a sharp divide.
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, whether it's more or less acute in any time or place, it's not unique to Islam in any sense. Right?
No, and not unique to Christendom. But these are, now, one of the things that we're fighting about within each of these civilizations is what relation we should have to the others, right? So you're right, it has, that's how the spillover, but the big fights are within, see? The fights are within about how we should relate to, among other things, how we should relate without, but...
So for example, in the current context of refugees, there is a strong Christian tradition of the idea of sanctuary, which becomes a motivation for many Christians to say it is our obligation to welcome and care for those who are in need.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's a sort of civilizational anxiety.
Yeah.
Oh, no, all those other people are coming and we're going to be swamped.
Yeah.
And that's a different response.
Yeah.
And so there's a struggle within broadly Christian heritage countries over how to respond.
So Viktor Orban in Hungary says we're keeping them out in the name of Christian civilization, and to some others of us, that sounds unbearably paradoxical.
Right.
You know, you refuse
it's
the people
at
the
Christian thing to say.
Exactly, but Christianity can mean these two things.
I wonder if we might move the discussion towards thinking a little bit about the role of government in the future of faith. There's certainly concern, even among our student body, about the role that government is now taking in identifying non-violent extremism and policing, as it were, religious enthusiasm of different kinds, concerns that that's a kind of stigmatizing of religiosity itself. And I wonder, is this a continuation of the modern project that you chart of the secular regulation of religion, or is this a new development? Is this seeking to achieve something different?
Well, it is, to some extent, a prolongation of that other kind of secularism. Let's call it the religion-controlling secularism as against, if you will, let's say, the diversity, you know, attempting to deal with diversity secularism, right? It is a continuation of that, but it's but it is sparked by the present situation and the present sense of threat that many people in the West have about Islam. And what I find very problematic about many of the measures taken under that impulse is that they really assume the truth of the fundamentalist position that there's only a single Islam and it's always been like that and it's never been any different. So when they find certain Muslims doing terrible things, I think, well, that must be dictated by the single Islam, right? So they get tremendously suspicious of people who have other kinds of piety in Islam, nothing to do with jihadism, you know, a woman wearing a headscarf or something of that kind. And they stigmatize this. And the result is, of course, they're helping the fundamentalists to get recruits. I mean, it's the most counterproductive thing that you could imagine governments doing, but the Western governments, I'm afraid, are not always, but they are very, very frequently falling into this trap. So, okay, one has to have a lot of surveillance in an age of terrorism, but there's got to be some understanding of the nature of the other faiths one's dealing with, in particular that tremendous variety in Islam, the fact that so much of what's working against that, the jihadism, is other kinds of Islam. And it's that one needs to have that kind of sense of. Otherwise, I mean, it's like bombing, you see. There's collateral damage. There's more collateral damage from stigmatizing than there is any gain. Just like if you just carpet bomb various parts of the Middle East, there's more collateral damage there than there is actual military.
One of the things that strikes me in this is the basis for understanding other faiths as complex and varied may be greater for somebody who comes from a background where they have a sense of experiencing complex and varied faith of their own. And so I see it in the interfaith group that Jim leads or in other settings, that actually students with some sense of that in one faith can make connections to people from different faith backgrounds that appreciate that heterogeneity, and that sometimes the stereotyping, Muslims are like this, Buddhists are like that, Christians are like that, reflects the absence of that experience of the internal heterogeneity.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And I mean, so there's the irony that that we often think of the faiths as opposed. Well, Jews and Muslims, they couldn't possibly get along. In certain ways, actually, religious experience gives tools for making connections that are not provided equally by the non-religious dimensions of secular society, which may more often say, well, we don't talk about that very much, or we have certain very limited ways of talking about it.
Yeah.
I wonder if we might tease out a little bit of the collateral damage that you allude to. And I know this is a question that interests Craig, of when religious discourse is suppressed in some way in society, what else might be lost?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is an immense possibility of losing the great variety of spiritual languages, if you like, in which people's searches can be carried out. And, you know, you could just see today that to some people, Buddhism speaks very powerfully. To other people, some kinds of Christianity speak powerfully. To other people, maybe even some kind of, you know, Nietzsche-derived atheism speaks very powerfully and so on. And the nature of our modern predicament is that the best thing we can do for our contemporaries is have these languages there available. Now, a certain kind of very narrow secularism wants to pound these out. I mean, you know, if nobody ever reads the Bible, you get these, you know, media in which people don't read the Bible anymore. They don't understand half the allusions in English literature, but never mind. But they just can't see what all this is about. I mean, you get very simple ideas. People have that faith is a matter of belief, you know.
But there's also the corresponding stereotype of the secular, right? That secularism is a matter of unbelief.
Yeah.
Whereas one may believe in a lot of things. One may have faith, in fact, and not faith in God, but faith in the potential goodness of other people, which is sometimes takes an act of faith because other people demonstrate not being good a lot of the time. and so the idea that there is a world of faith and a world of simple unbelief or unfaith misstates both, right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. I mean, the word faith is tremendously misunderstood in a lot of the discussions around, and that's you have to have lost contact with what that religious language means in order to have such a simplistic view, you see? So one thing you lose is, if you like, want to look at it from not my point of view, your point of view, the point of view of everyone, we lose the richness of these languages of search. The next thing we lose is we don't understand each other. See, because we narrow down to understanding only people very much like us. And both of these are disasters in our kind of society, right?
So is there maybe a third kind of loss or some other issue there? Jim, I'm remembering a conversation you were here for with Bruno Latour and Rowan Williams, where we were, among other things, talking about nature and the ways available to us of connecting deeply, the deep ecology movement or people, the existential threat posed by climate change and the very, I've often stressed, the beauty of nature, our sense of the appreciation. Well, we have in religious traditions a variety of ways for trying to talk about that.
Yeah.
And we have in what Charles has called the immanent frame a certain flattening of this, a certain enclosure within a flatter discourse of causes and effects that doesn't open up to us. And so what I'm hoping for is the idea of the transcendent as something that reaches beyond the immanent frame that need not be inherently about the divine, which will, for so many people's sense of the meaning of nature, will be a connection to God and creation, but others will be a connection to nature in a way that isn't defined by God and creation, but will still reach beyond. It will still have a certain transcendence and put our own lives in a perspective that's different. But that's harder to talk. We end up talking about that, even in secular discourses, often using somewhat religious language.
Yes. I mean, what's fascinating is that just in the period when the immanent frame gets, as it were, finally settled into our view of the natural world, we have the Romantic period, you see, in which there is this attempt to recover some kind of contact with nature,
right.
But it is of a kind that is ontically very indefinite. It doesn't necessarily say God, it doesn't necessarily... So Wordsworth is a wonderful example of this, you see, because Wordsworth speaks of the Tintern Abbey, the force that passes through all things. And you find in the 19th century in the UK, but also elsewhere, that Orthodox Christians, which Wordsworth became himself later on, relate to this. George Eliot, who's an atheist, relates to this. Meredith relates to this. I mean, so many people are inspired by that. So you get a new kind of area of language in which there's an attempt to suggest something greater, but without ever finally defining it. I mean, this is, I think, something that I'd like to study.
It's interesting. And in terms of thinking about the future, since Jim's asked us to think about the future of faith, since we face a future which doesn't obviously amount to just more of the same as our present.
Yeah.
So we are have a pretty heightened consciousness today of potential transformations or transformations that are already underway. So climate change is one, but also the deep transformation in the terms of cultural belonging that underpins anxieties about foreigners and refugees, or the potential for real destabilization of either the global economy or warfare and terms of all these things. So as we think about that with climate change, say, we think about what would it mean for the world to exist and human beings not to exist, and which is a possible thing. Maybe nature then could recover from the damage human beings had inflicted. But we wouldn't be there in some ways. So we're forced to rethink something very basic about existence. And what I wonder is, does this produce an occasion in which many people are seeking for ways to think that aren't dictated by technical knowledge or by other sorts of familiar tools from the immanent frame? To think beyond it, and is this linked to some sort of flowering? Or, I mean, you've even used the language of a supernova. I mean, a sort of, a lot of engagements, but of very different kinds.
You see, I think that it's a parallel to or extension of the change I mentioned earlier to the immanent frame. Let's think of it in terms of the cosmos, where we cease to think of a cosmos of orders, of higher good and lower good, and think of just the cosmos that Newton, roughly speaking, revealed. And now we have a further step. I mean, so that used to be the context, and now it isn't anymore. We have a further step to the context of, wow, we could not be here anymore, right? Not only is this not a meaningful cosmos in the older sense, but it's one that we could be wiped out of, right? It's not necessarily related to human beings. And just as the romantic poetry is a response to the first, so different kinds of, not just poetic, but spiritual explorations are going to be a response to the second. Where in the Anthropocene, as people say, the period that is dominated by human power to transform.
And so some of this will take the form of revisiting the book of Revelation and trying to figure out the symbolism. But some of it will take the form of the development of very new ways of thinking in this context. I mean, you've talked about innovators in the past and the creation of the Franciscan and the Benedictine orders and all of this, but that we're in a period where I think one of the main ways of talking about religion is manifestly false. That is, that it's all inheritance from the past.
Yeah.
That religion is what we inherit from the past, what we learn from our parents, what we learn in Sunday school, what we learn in the community we grew up in. And I think what you're pointing us to is religion is a realm of innovation and invention and exploration.
Yeah, constantly. And more so when you have these big, big epochal changes, right?
To
the immanent frame, to the Anthropocene age. Yeah, and there is this. But it also, I mean, this constantly related to the past. I mean, I'm thinking of the way certain psalms about the cosmos and so on can take on a new meaning in this particular situation. Psalms 96, 98, I think, particularly have a another kind of resonance. Yeah.
I wonder where we might see this kind of innovation taking place. It does seem to me that there is a certain resurgence of religious discourse in the public sphere, but so much of it seems to be just expression of the imminent frame, a rather thin kind of politicization, whether it's the Lord's Prayer being banned in the cinema or discourse about Islam in Western Europe. Where might more fruitful conversations about the transcendence be taking place?
Well, I think they're taking place in, I was going to say, sort of ecumenical media, but these don't exist as a kind of official existence. But there's interesting that there are more and more conversations across these barriers between people. And I mean, this is you're kind of a sight of this, right? I mean,
yeah, it's happening here.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's right. And these are, and what are they sparked by? Well, they're sparked by people who are themselves seeking, recognize that others are, therefore immediately recognize a kind of, similarity, fellow feeling, right, even across boundaries. And then beyond that, the sense that there's something to learn from each other. Now, this is going very much farther than simply between different recognize religious positions. I know media where atheists and believers are getting together with exactly this spirit, right? Tell me what really moves you about your. I really want to know, what. And that is the new kind, the positive new kind of relationship, which is, if you like, appropriate to this age. I mean, both appropriate because there are these differences, and appropriate because the experience of people who are really searching is one which draws you to others who are searching. You want to have some kind of exchange with them. It's very interesting. I mean, take the place of ecumenical exchange in our world. I'll just take the Catholic Church again, right? Good example. So Vatican II happened, and then a lot of people wanted to sort of go back in a lot of that, right? And now we have Francis, fortunately, propelling us forward. But a lot of people wanted to go back. They didn't go back on the ecumenical dimension, right? Yeah. See, it's something too powerful in modern experience, I think, too.
That is one thing, and maybe last thing before we, I know you want to open it up. This is partly about beliefs and understanding each other's beliefs. It's partly about what moves you and asking a way that's not just belief, beyond belief in a sense, but it's partly about community, right? And so a part of religious experience for a lot of people has been community, and a part of what is sought by people who are seeking is community. So it's not only the set of beliefs you should believe in, the catechism that should replace the old catechism or something. It is fellowship. It is community that people seek, and that they don't necessarily expect to find only inside common belief.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Thank you. Well, time to open up to the floor. There should be a roving mic around somewhere, and if you would like to ask a question, can you please say your name and what you're studying, and you're probably studying here, but if you're studying somewhere else, let us know. And I can see Nick's hand up there, so can we get the mic over to him? Do we have a mic? Nick, why didn't you stand up and shout at us?
Okay, thank you. My name's Nick Spencer. I'm research director at a Christian think tank based in Westminster called Theos.
The mic has reached you, Nick.
There you go.
Good. Yes, am I on? Good.
Yep.
My name is Nick Spencer. I'm a research director for a Christian think tank called Theos, based in Westminster. Firstly, thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. I want to bring in a word that hasn't been mentioned so far, which is China. I think China is a fascinating example of the, if you like, the transformation from an imminent frame. It's been reported recently that there are probably more Christians in China now than there are in Europe. And it strikes me that the Chinese authorities are fascinated by the role of religion, and in particular Christianity, in public life. I wanted you to comment a little bit, really, on what that meant for your thesis of the need to move beyond immanence, if you like, and also what it means globally if the economic centre of gravity in the world is shifting eastwards at the same time as perhaps the Christian centre of gravity is.
Thank you.
Well, I think that the Chinese context is very different from the Western context because, I mean, there is this completely different grid. I mean, there is this idea of what religions are, which don't include Confucianism, which was thought of as a religion, and there are these five recognized religions and so on. So you have a very, very different context. But you had an enforced, I mean, if you like, an enforced immanent frame under a Marxist government for a long time. And now the lid is off in a way, and there's more freedom. People are, and now particularly that the sort of Maoist sense of the forward movement has really dissipated, people are looking for meaning in their lives. So we have a situation in which there's a lot of searching, and a lot of searching takes the form of, well, Christianity, but also Falun Gong and other options. Now, I think that there you have the Chinese government in a totally conflicted position, and they don't know what to do about it. I mean, they think they know in any given moment, but they change. So they obviously don't know, right? They, on one hand, they, you know, you depend in a modern economy, a modern society, on people having some kind of ethical framework which keeps them, you know, honest and so on. So they welcome it from that point of view. From another point of view, they're terrified that this might get out of control, right? So you have the vicious attack on Falun Gong because it was infiltrating the party and they can't just, you know. And then you get this attack on certain Christian churches. And the thing is more complicated by the fact that it's not always orders from the center. It's also the local party people. So I think we have a real, really very, very confused situation there. But what you do have is through another route coming to something like the same place, that there are lots of people who are searching for some kind of personal religion. Right? The same can be said in other ways about Korea, Taiwan, other, you know, East Asian societies.
Yeah, just two thoughts. One is I agree with that. I think you're right that to use a word like perplexity or something. The Chinese government's really interested, is fascinated. It's not just unilaterally hostile, and it's certainly not embracing, in a sense. And so there is official atheism, but there is also a sense of risk. So the response to churches, but that for that matter to Falun Gong or to Buddhists or others, is partly about organizations and organizing that is outside the reach of party control. So it's not just about what people believe. It's about people coming together in groups in an organizing way that is worrisome. And hence you see the split in the treatment of Catholics and the attempt to have some control over the appointment of the bishop and things. But the government, I think, needs to be seen as not repressing at all. So that it's not the case that the Chinese government has simply repressed religion. It's repressed some religion by some people under some circumstances. And so the puzzle is what's making the decisions in that, and how does that work? Why is Falun Gong just absolutely anathema and you know, completely beyond the pale, while there are different responses to Christians or to Buddhists or to others? And the Chinese government, at least some within or connected to the Chinese government, have participated in a renewal of Confucianism, including of some Confucian practices that seem, quote, religious, so that they haven't simply asserted Confucianism is a philosophy and you are an atheist and you have this philosophy. They have engaged in some greater permission for renewal of relations among clans to ancestors and to some exaltation of the sort of family structure of within a Confucian tradition. So there is some sort of search for
something going on there. I don't know how to label it. I would say one other thing, though, about your point about the shift in the world. It is absolutely true that there's this shift towards a different center of gravity. East would be one way to look at it, and China's enormous rise. In the transformation of Christendom, as Chuck referred to it, in that the pluralization, that the majority of Christians are in the global South and East. And so this tendency to think of religion as us, and then to let us be somewhat colored by race or culture or country, and not fully grasp, you know, where is the growth in Christianity? It's in Africa and in China and in a range of places that aren't the traditional centers. And that's at the same time, right, there's a growth of Islam in Europe, and there's a growth of other, this rearrangement is very troubling to people's senses of what the world ought to look like when it's stable.
Thank you. And there's a hand there. Yes, the lady. Back.
When I see how this applies with regard to just sort of a Christian path, and you mentioned St. Augustine or Francis or maybe even Martin Luther or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I wonder where is space for innovation in religion nowadays, especially as most people would, I would argue, see religion, the different religions, as guardians of, you know, sort of very ancient traditions, forms of behavior, ways of thinking. What exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of examples of innovative practices in it, I realize your question points out a very important limitation to what I've been saying, because take Christian meditation, for instance. A lot of people are taking up now in the Christian churches. So is this an innovation? Well, in one sense, it is. I mean, I'm thinking of the person who started this particular movement, John Mayne. I mean, he got it from his guru when he was in Malaysia and began to meditate with a Hindu guru, right? But then he discovered the sources for this kind of thing in John Cassian, in the Desert Fathers, right? So it's these are innovations that have a component of recovery of the tradition. The point is that the Christian tradition, but this, I can say this, Islamic, I can say, you know, almost anything here in the Buddhist, almost put anything there and say it's incredibly more plural than we've been led to believe, and certainly than the more conservative proponents of these religions lead us to believe. So, to some extent, innovations are never entirely innovative. I mean, they pick up on something. See, that's there in the tradition.
But there's the new also, I think. I mean, so that if I follow rightly, Charles, that each religious tradition involves more plural resources than any particular set of Orthodox teachings would allow. So there are these things you can discover. So when feminist theologians rethink parts of the Christian tradition, they are partly finding resources that were always already there but neglected, but they're partly innovating. They partly are really thinking anew. And there are versions of this in different settings. There's also a lot of syncretism, right? So there's a lot of, I'm going to take something from each of two traditions or three traditions. I'm not going to feel that I am bound to learn only from one religious tradition. So for my own spiritual life, I will be informed by different traditions, even within one. So in Christianity, you might say, well, the way in which Easter figures in the Orthodox tradition really speaks to me, and I'm going to learn from the Orthodox tradition, though I remain Protestant or Catholic or whatever. I mean, but beyond, so you have a variety of people who find things that speak to them from the Buddhist tradition, but they're not, in a strict sense, Buddhists. There's a lot, then third, of actual conversion. There's a high level of change. Now, that's not radically new in history either. There have been conversions before. But there's a pretty high level of voluntary individual conversion as distinct from conversions of whole countries or communities going on now, and that's part of the seeking. And then for some people, there's sort of the new age or the beyond religion versions of this. I want to be very spiritual. I feel spiritual. I don't feel religious. Religion means to me an orthodoxy. I don't want any orthodoxy, but I do want ways of being spiritual. So and in each of these, it seems to me, there are all this wealth of past resources that Charles points to, but there also are the chances to really do something new. And part of what people do is, in that sense, sometimes really new and not a repetition.
Yeah, Joe, there. Can we get the microphone down?
Hello, I'm Joe. I'm a third-year politics and philosophy student here at LSE. What struck me was, Craig, when you mentioned something about community, and I was brought up in this country in progressive Jewish community, feeling very close to a religious tradition that, to me, always felt very far away from orthodoxy or anything of a doctrinal nature. I'm not out to convert anyone. I'm not out to preach. And so why, in your opinion, if I happen to say to people who I perceive to be very smart, people at LSE, that I'm religious, are they so terrified of me?
Very good question.
Well, answering that as the director of the LSE. No. So I think it's a really interesting question, and I don't have a really large, whole, complex answer. One thread of it, I think, is why are people afraid of religion is the identification of religion with much more aggressive orthodoxies. If you're religious, what you must mean is you're going to preach. You must mean you want to convert me. You must mean you think there is one right way to live which you wish to impose, which most religious people don't feel like that necessarily, but there's a lot of sense of anxiety about that. But another is, and probably at LSE included, this must mean you are not willing to discuss within the terms of rational debate. You're going to bring something else into the discussion that comes from outside of those things that we can both talk about rationally, and therefore I don't know how to deal with this, right? And this also seems to be a misperception, since there's huge volumes of rational debate among people who are religious and not religious, that this isn't. But there is, I think, because of the identification of religion with beliefs as distinct from communities or practices or spirituality or something, once it becomes beliefs, then it's a set of beliefs versus other beliefs, and they may be beliefs that seem to be held on bases other than science and therefore at odds with science, and you have a clash, which I think is one of the impediments to interfaith and or, simply broader, secular and religious alike, understanding this idea that it's all about beliefs gets in the way.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That you're adding some extra premises that nobody else can understand even now, right? And so we can't argue because you're throwing in these extra premises.
In effect, you will cheat in the discussion, right? Yeah. You will say God spoke to you, and what can I say when you say God spoke to you, right? And that's,
Good question. Thank you. Arthur, here.
Thank you very much. I'm a PhD student at Cambridge University. You just mentioned the fact that Pope Francis was propelling us forward. And what strikes me about Pope Francis is that the more he becomes popular amongst non-believers, the more he becomes controversial among Catholics. And I'm just wondering, is there a way to innovate Catholicism without alienating the so-called conservative part of the Catholic community? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, there has to be some recognition, some greater recognition of plurality of approaches for that really to take place. I mean, that... it's the attempt to impose on everyone certain modes of spirituality which actually just taken on their own are very, have something to be said for them, or very, can be seen to be very powerful for the people who are engaged in them. And it's the attempt to impose these which makes the dialogue very, very difficult. So we're a little bit back, you see, in the older forms, particularly the forms that arose from the Reformation were all so concerned with defending the boundary against the others and so on, that they were stepping on people in within their own church that sounded, I mean, sounded Lutheran or sounded Catholic if you're working from the other side. And there's been a long tradition of operating like that, kind of hair trigger sense, this rings bells or something, right? They have to get over that. Yeah. They have to get, more conservative side have to get over that.
It's also worth saying that conservatives innovate sometimes. Yeah. That it's not as though having the claim to conserve only that which has always been true from the past never involves innovating in certain ways. Sometimes there are innovations in the name of the conservatives.
Yeah, and they don't realize. I mean, the innovations that they don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Any hands at the back? I'm going to stand up a little bit so that I can see people who might be asking questions at the back. No, they're timid at the back. Well, have this lady at the front then, the mic down.
Hi, I'm Sophie. I'm a master's student at King's. And my question is, you spoke a bit about certain forms of religion controlling or religion suppressing secularism, and that may be leading to sort of religious illiteracy that makes dialogue difficult. And my question is, how can society, multiple societies, Western society, combat that on a systematic level? And I come at it, I'm an American, so I was raised in under the sort of separation of church and state, which I think has led to a very religiously illiterate populace. And I'm wondering, is it the responsibility of the school system? Is it the responsibility of the people who teach young people? Can we do it in adult communities and adult centers, and how you see the future of that evolving?
Yeah,
good question.
I mean, there's many, many possible answers to this, but I have to say in Quebec we have adopted a particular answer, that we moved from confessional schools about 15 years ago, I guess. We moved from having confessional Catholic Protestant schools, public schools funded by the, but confessional, to simply French and English, right? And within these, there's no more confessional education. But the idea was to introduce a course of religions and ethical cultures, right, which would give the pupils the idea of what kind of, well, actually tremendous variety exists in the world around them, so that they wouldn't have totally no understanding of what it was to be a Muslim, what it was to be, etc. And the idea would negatively defend them against believing in stereotypes that people try to force on them, but positively it might lead to greater understanding of what's involved here. I noticed that Régis Debray has said the same thing in the French scene, and so who's much more laïque than I am. Other things separate me from Régis Debray. But so this idea is coming up here and there. There must be a way of teaching about this that isn't confessional, but that will give our young people, our students, some sense of what's out there in the human world.
In the UK, there is actually a growing amount of attempt to teach religious literacy. And one issue is what kind of knowledge is involved for those who teach it. And so often it is not based on extensive study and education and having, you know, developed a very subtle way of doing it. It's a teacher who's pulled into that. You've been given this extra class. Go teach the religious literacy class. And so I think the effort to somewhat professionalize this and build a real educational base for it, so that so that better knowledge informs the effort, is important, because it's a really fraught terrain to have people who are not of a particular religious background teaching about that religion to people, to kids, And it can provoke all sorts of controversies with the parents of the kids, with the community, with all that. So it's really important, but some thought needs to go into doing it well, because the well-meaning can be problematic.
This is the opportunity there to promote our faith and leadership program, which, for which there is a flyer on your seat, religious literacy with leadership development. Next question, this lady here, yes.
Hi, my name is Maggie, and I'm a PhD student here at LSE. My question is really on the politics of evangelical Christianity, and I'm thinking about Kenya in particular, where I'm from. So we have this ongoing case with the International Criminal Court, and you know, our leaders, our president and vice president, being indicted, and one is now off the hook. But where Christianity, when they were elected into power, the first thing that the vice president did was break down in front of everybody and thank God and went straight to church. And therefore, it seemed as if our memory of sort of post-election violence was sort of wiped clean because, you know, he displayed some sort of humility and the idea and question of God and forgiveness came into the conversation. And so the politics has turned into this thing where even corruption will be excused by prayer or by a leader going to church. And then also, you know, bring into this setting as well the war on terror. And now you have this question of American sort of support, military support for our war against al-Shabaab and how Christians are now being pitted against Muslims and who rightfully then belongs to Kenya. But within all of these conversations is this politicization of evangelical Christianity in particular, and I just wonder what your sort of take or opinion would be on that question, because I think it's very illuminated on the question, and you know, I think it's a growing and burning issue as to justice and things like that.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I don't know lots and lots about the situation, but a couple thoughts. First, the politicization of lots of religious positions in very troubling ways, and the interrelationship of that with nationalism is a fairly large issue that includes in this context, as you rightly observe. On evangelical Christianity, there's something interesting going on. This has often been a faith that has been insistently not political, and then at certain points, very intensively politically mobilized faith communities. And so this is, you know, for good or for bad in various ways. That is, evangelical Christianity plays a big role in the anti-slavery movement. So there are points at which it's politicized in favor of causes that we're more likely to think are good causes. But there is an underestimate. There's a huge spread of different forms of evangelical Christianity and of Pentecostalism in various settings. And part of what you're talking about is the work that is done politically by the apparently not political character of that faith community, right? So it's politicization in the specific sense that it does political work for the image of a political leader to appear to deal with this in this non-political way of religious forgiveness. And I just want to note that paradox. It's not the sort of straightforward politicization of that you see with the new religious right in the United States or something, and people are just campaigning on religion. It's the work being done by the idea that religion stands for the moral outside of the political, which may be illusory, but the very capacity to play this role is provided by that.
I mean, I'm not that okay.
Do we leave it there? Questions? Sana? We get the mic around there. Wait for the mic. It's coming across.
Well, thank you very much. I came here
nice
today.
Place to your mouth, please.
I'm Sana Musharraf, a postgrad student from Pakistan. And I call myself a self-convert Muslim, if that is how I may define myself. I was looking for clarity while we were discussing several issues. However, the greater the vision expanses, the greater ambiguity arises. And I was wondering whether self-doubt is a good or bad habit in religion itself. I may sound agnostic or atheistic for a moment, but I think it was Bernard Shaw who said that man created religion. And what would you signify? How would you emphasize on the significance of religion or its presence, be it in any form? That's something which will help me get some clarity in the ambiguity. Thank you.
I think that doubt is almost unavoidable, sister faith. I mean, that, particularly if you understand your faith as maybe moving you somewhere, that faith is a journey. It's never having arrived at. If you think you've arrived, you're making a mistake. And I think that in moving forward, doubt plays a role, or perplexity can produce doubt, plays a very important role. So there is a certain way of treating doubt as a welcome but worrying guest, right? And if you hang in there and live through the doubt, it may be the path to go farther on your faith journey. So but you have to understand faith as a journey rather than as a point of arrival. Right? But I think that one of the features of this world of seekers is that less and less people think of it as a point of arrival, and more people think of it as a journey. Yeah.
I've got other hands up. Craig, do you want to? Great. So can we get the mic down to the front to Matthew, please?
Yeah.
My name is Matthew Engelke. I study anthropology here at the LSE. I wanted to pick up on the set of questions and points that have been made in relation to what's lost with the suppression of certain vocabularies, mm-hmm. certain registers of speaking. And maybe I can ask it by posing what might seem like a flippant question, but I think is hopefully a very serious one, which is, if you had not cut your teeth as a young scholar on Hegel and other grand German thinkers, but had instead published A Secular Age as your first book, do you think you would have gotten tenure? And I'm asking that because I wonder how you see the register of A Secular Age in relation to the broader tradition of philosophy, humanistic, other humanistic fields, and indeed the social sciences, as having crowded out certain ways of speaking, certain registers of language. And do you think A Secular Age, or are you trying in A Secular Age to kind of push beyond what the academy might expect, especially of junior scholars?
Well, yeah, I mean, but there are several reasons why I wouldn't have got tenure, but we have to look at them. I mean, one, and they have to do with the time, with the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, if I can speak like Hegel. You see, for one thing, back there was an even stronger idea in philosophy that it's kind of self-contained discipline, right? Whereas the kind of thinking you need to address the questions the secular age addresses is situated in a kind of interspace, philosophy, sociology, history, right? And so that would have shocked people even more. I mean, a lot of very analytic philosophers still think, you know, he's not really a philosopher. But it's less shocking now. Secondly, let's say 30, 40 years ago, it was a period in which the standard orthodox post-Weberian secularization theory, the more modernity progresses, the more belief falls away, was very dominant. Now, it's very important for the success of this book that we were talking about that it happened after a lot of people said, no, that story doesn't work, that story doesn't work, that story doesn't work. So what the world needs more of is alternative stories, and I just threw out an alternative story. So, you know, a lot of people think, there's nothing wrong with it, I'm sure they're right, there's a lot wrong with it, but
let's start kicking this around and seeing, you know, how this works. If I published that exactly same book in 1960, it would have come from outer space. I mean, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. We all know that secularization happens inevitably. I mean, right? I mean, it's reason and, you know, see? There was a great softening up period where people thought, no, it doesn't work here. No, it doesn't work there. No, you know. And it was in that, the fact that it was published at that moment, you might almost say providential. But I mean, it's my own slowness of thinking, you know. I thought of this book in the 1960s, but, you know, fortunately, I think very, very slowly. So, it, you know.
But you also, I just, a footnote is, in addition to Hegel in your trajectory to this book, there's a lot of thinking about what it means to be human,
yeah,
and whether it means something more than can be understood by purely mechanistic explanation,
yeah,
of how,
yeah,
people behave.
Yeah.
And so the era of a sort of completely external view of behavior,
yeah,
and the attempt to construct causal accounts of everything humans do,
yeah,
on that basis,
yeah,
you were already criticized in 1963, not in any way that was explicitly religious, but which was opening up the discourse, and
yeah,
similarly in work on language and,
yeah,
agency and so forth. You're trying to open up a different view of the human, which it seems to me does open a path to the secular age,
yeah,
book,
yeah,
but also to concerns that are not only about religion and secularism,
yeah,
and can be approached from a variety of different views.
Yeah.
What they can't be approached from is that particular,
yeah,
insular,
yeah, right,
notion.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Greg, you wrote about religion from fairly early on in your career, didn't you? Were you worried about getting tenure?
I didn't write a lot about religion early on. I mean, yeah, a few things. I certainly was worried about getting tenure, though. I wrote a lot about Marx and Marxism, which is why I was worried,
right,
about getting tenure.
Yes, can we get the mic up there?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Leslie. I'm a master's student here at LSE. And we had a question earlier about why people are afraid when they find out that you're religious. And then we had the suggestion that perhaps people assume that the argument that you bring to the table is irrational. And my question is, with certain, for instance, counterterrorism initiatives like Prevent in the UK taking form on campuses, where does the responsibility lie in order to stimulate conversations between professors and students who might assume that the religious stance or perhaps the religious garb is irrational or a sign of irrational debate?
It's a good question, and it's something I do hear quite a lot from students.
Well, I'll answer first and jump at it. I think in the Prevent legislation and some of the ways it's interpreted are potentially very dangerous for being able to have strong, rich intellectual engagement with each other, of communities in which we can explore our different backgrounds but also our new ideas, because they encourage the labeling very quickly of these ideas for those who don't follow the ins and outs of the government's anti-terrorist legislation and Prevent. One of the issues of Prevent is it says that universities and their faculties must take on an obligation to not only seek to prevent terrorism, but to seek to identify and report pre-terrorist possible leanings or explanations. So it's hard to know what this means in the first place. But in the second place, for many people, it seems to mean things like you're reading Islamic texts a lot. That's worrying me, or something. And so this category of before anyone has said or done anything that can be described as illegal or terrorist, we somehow must monitor their thought is very, very worrying. And the responsibility lies with all of us, I think, to insist on really dealing with other people as people, really dealing with other ideas and other thoughts on some fair terms, and not leaping to categorizations.
Mm. Do you
want to add anything? Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
Well, I'm afraid we need to wind up there, and I certainly end this conversation feeling that the future of faith can at least be innovative, which has been a big thing and a huge source of stimulating thought. So I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank Craig, but most of all, I want to thank Professor Charles Taylor, and we look forward to your lecture this evening. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.